Good evening, everybody. My name is Kate Pretty. I'm the chairman of the Faculty Board of Archaeology and Anthropology, and I have been for 20 years the Liechtenstein Trust, that is the MacDonald Trust's representative on the MacDonald Management Committee. So I am taking a long view. I've been asked to say why this evening is important. In other words, why are we not just having a single lecturer? Why are we having the benefit of two? And a little bit about the 20 years of the MacDonald Institute. But I will say probably very little because I know that Professor Lord Renfrew's view is to take on the past, and that of Graham Barker is to deal with the present and the future. So I don't want to risk saying anything that Colin is going to introduce you to. Why was I ever involved in this? I think, looking back, it was because in those days I was chairman of the Arts Building Committee for the Financial Board, as it then was. And I was pulled into discussion with this charming, determined Scot who had been opportunistically bagged by Colin on his journeys round the university of Great Britain, looking for somewhere which would build him the institute of his dreams. And he met Colin, and their ideas matched. It was an enormously interesting time to be working with Dr. MacDonald, because he had very clear ideas about buildings. And indeed, he was absolutely determined that if he could, he would have a classical building for his institute, preferably designed by Quinlan Terry. The reason we didn't have Quinlan Terry in the end was that he designed us a shell and then said calmly, "Of course, I know nothing about laboratories," at which point even Dr. Mack lost some of his enthusiasm for the classical, feeling that his architect of choice hadn't perhaps got the right idea. What I liked about the early years of working with Dr. MacDonald as well was that he was extremely determined that his institute would be a major money earner as well as a money spender. He had not become an inventor out of lack of a care for detail. And for instance, he was passionate about the sorts of windows that the MacDonald Institute should have. When you go back, please look at the windows. They fit his idea of what windows, of sustainable windows, should look like. He knew about sustainability, or perhaps cost, long before we did. Again, some of my early memories of working with Dr. MacDonald is to have Colin say calmly, "We need some new whatever it is equipment." And Dr. Mack would say to him, "Janice, we've got some of that back in the garage at home. Will you make sure that Colin gets it?" So he was an interesting person to work with. He had a vision. I think that Colin has achieved that vision for him in the early years of the working that they did together on the building of the MacDonald Institute and of its realization. And I'm sure that he would be very pleased to be here today. We miss him, that he cannot see the first 20 years of his inspiration. Now, Colin, now mark this, because you have to follow this plot. I'm going to just give you a very brief biography. You can be forgiven for thinking I'm going to follow it exactly in 40 minutes' time. Colin Renfrew, Disney professor, director, Disney professor from 1981, director of the Institute from 1991 to 2004, was an undergraduate at St. John's College, and did his PhD there in 1965. He had a connection with the British School at Athens, and he worked in the University of Sheffield between 1965 and I think 1972. He is not the same person who did always exactly the same things that I shall introduce to you in about 40 minutes, but it's a very interesting parallel. What can I say about Colin that you don't know already? One of the great archaeological thinkers of this of the last century and of this, somebody who admits quite freely in talking to Paul Mellors on Friday at a dinner that he can't quite get his mind round the Mousterian question, but nevertheless, of course, has a hand in archaeology of all sorts. Colin, who jogs, who bikes, who's impervious to cold, anybody who's been with him in Orkney knows about his hardihood. He's still actively digging. He has, of course, in his time at the MacDonald, introduced some of the things which have been of the greatest possible interest to us. Work on human DNA, work on the spread of languages, work on the illicit antiquities, and I'm going to challenge him not to talk about Roman helmets this evening. Sorry, if you don't know that, it's because he asked a question or was about to ask a question in the House about the Roman helmet recently sold. He is a man of great passion, of foresight, of, as I say, opportunism, if I dare use that word. And it is because he seized the moment when Dr. Mac Hove interview that we got the MacDonald Institute started. That seems a good place to let him take over from me. Colin Renfrew.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, for that very nice introduction. So I'll begin straight away because we're looking forward to hearing the next Disney professor in 40 minutes' time. It was in June 1988 that I received a letter in my capacity as head of the Department of Archaeology from a solicitor called Christopher Harmer, and he said that he represented an industrialist whose name was blanked out on the letter. I spent a long time trying to read it with only partial success, and that this industrialist was interested in archaeology and would be very keen to visit us in the Department of Archaeology and see what we were up to. So I naturally wrote with enthusiasm, saying he'd be very welcome to visit, and in my diary for the 12th of July 1988, I have the entry, my appointment diary, visit of mystery donor. The mystery donor was, as it turned out, Mr. MacDonald, Dr. Mac, as he was known, because he had a medical degree as well as a BSc in electronic engineering from the University of Glasgow. So he, with Christopher Harmer, and his other advisor, Ken Mosley, visited us on that day, and he came to see the laboratories, and we took some time to show him the things that we hoped he wanted to see. He seemed to move through them very quickly. He was he had many qualities, one of which was he could be described, I think, as a no-nonsense individual. Certainly, I always felt that. So we went through the laboratories, and then we went to lunch in Jesus College, where I was then living, and in the Master's Lodge. So we had very lively discussion. Paul Mellors was very prominent in these discussions. I think also Nicholas Postgate was at that lunch. And so the discussions went on for an hour after lunch. And then at about 3 o'clock, Dr. Mac said, well, thank you very much. And he left with Mr. Mosley and Mr. Harmer, and that was that. So I felt a little downcast, although I hoped he'd enjoyed his lunch, as it were. And then I didn't hear anything for some time. But then I had a letter from Christopher Harmer saying he and Ken Mosley would like to call on me again. So this time I thought, well, we won't go through the lunch manoeuvre, we'll make it morning coffee. So they called on the 1st of November 1988, Ken Mosley said, it's been decided that we, that's to say Dr. MacDonald, would like to offer the department £100,000 a year for field work and research for 5 years. Would that be acceptable? So that was the easy question. Then he said, would you like to indicate how you would dispose of a larger sum? Now, that was a much more difficult question, as you can imagine. But I thought, and I'd for a long time had in mind, that we really needed new laboratories and we needed facilities, essentially. I also had in mind that it wasn't a good idea to give money to the university in a general sense, because it might be used in a general way. And so I thought it would be wiser to have a specific function which would be for postgraduate and research, because after all, it was the university's obligation to do the undergraduate teaching, to finance the undergraduate teaching, which it was doing well enough, apart from the laboratories. But we really had no research side, except we had a lot of good research students. And so I indicated that this was my thinking, and I agreed to write further about that to Dr. Mack. So the next thing I did was to call on the Secretary General of the Faculties, James Wright, and he was enormously effective. He said, I think the university had missed a possible funding opportunity in the previous year through being a little bit slow off the mark. He was not slow off the mark. He said, yes, it's a very good idea. Of course you need a building. That's what I was suggesting. Why don't you put it in the middle of the courtyard of that part of the site, of the Downing site, where there had been temporary huts? And he said, the one thing I must warn you is that you must have an endowment. If you're going to get a building, we can discuss the building, but you must have an endowment. And he also organised an architect, Peter Bolton, to do a sketch plan of how such a building might look. And that was funded by the Secretary General of the Faculties. So I have to pay tribute to him and to the university. They were really quick off the mark. So I was able to write to Dr. MacDonald and arrange for him to visit us again, which he did on the 16th and 17th of December, that same year, 1988. And he came, and we entertained him as well as we could. He stayed in the Master's Lodge. The choir came and sang to him in person, holding candles. We had a very good party, drinks party that evening, when he met, for the first time in some cases, a number of the people associated with the department and active in the department. And I want to pay tribute to my colleagues in the department. Dr. Mack, I'm sure, decided to come to Cambridge. He had already been to one other university and not been very fascinated by what he saw. I think he was impressed by the range of what he saw, and he was also very interested himself in early metrology. He must have had a phenomenal mental arithmetic capacity in his youth, and he could convert Sumerian cubits to Hittite, whatever they were, in no time at all, and had written several papers on the subject. So here he is on the right with Jane and Tjeerd van Andel. And here he is with another significant figure, who is also here this evening, Chris Scar, who became the deputy director of the Institute. And here you see a number of the figures at this party. On the left, you see the professor of classical archaeology. You see other distinguished figures there, including on the right, Ken Mosley, who is on the screen there. And so that was the group which met him. And here you see Paul Mellors and Joan Oates, who are also part of the team who welcomed him, along with Anthony Snodgrass and the other people I was mentioning. And here on the extreme left, you see Ken Mosley with Todd Whitelaw, and there you see also Josie John, who became the first secretary of the Institute. And it was then that we formulated together a form of words which did find its way into the statutes. The object of the Institute shall be to further research into all aspects of the early human past and its expression, and the variety of early human achievement, customs and practice in every part of the world. The work of the Institute shall include archaeological fieldwork and excavation, shall be interdisciplinary in character, and shall involve collaboration with the environmental and other sciences, and with disciplines relevant to the development of the human cognitive faculties, and shall be designed to lead to the collation and publication of data and conclusions. And I believe it was on that occasion that the doctor, who I think already decided what he wanted to do, made up his mind. We'd already done costings, and it was estimated that a building was likely to cost £5 million. It was thought that an appropriate endowment for such a building would also be of the order of £5 million. And so we took it from there. And Ken Moseley was of great help, and he advised that it would be a very good thing to get things going as soon as possible. And so he suggested, and Dr. MacDonald agreed, that we should have temporary premises, which Dr. Mac rented for us in Sydney Street, above Boots the Chemist, as it turned out. And we got a number of things going. We got the Grants and Awards Fund, that was the £100,000 a year, which came in handy. So we set up various projects. We arranged for the annual MacDonald Lecture, which is now, this is now the 22nd. We began to get the Cambridge Archaeological Journal organised, which we did, the lunchtime seminars, and the first MacDonald Conference, and then the monograph series. So the early projects, which I'll refer to further in a moment, were those. And the Nucleus Institute started with Chris Scar as acting deputy director, and Stephen Mithen, who was associate editor at that time of the Cambridge Archaeological Journal, and with Jack Fairhurst as our administrator. And I have some photographs of the first MacDonald Lecture, which was given by Alexander Marshak, whom you see here. And there is Sir Graham Clark, who was also present and was very encouraging to Dr. MacDonald. There's Ernest Gellner, who was then Professor of Social Anthropology. And there is the Vice-Chancellor, second from the left, Michael McCrum, with Dr. Mack, second from the right. And here is James Wright, Jim Wright, the Secretary General of the Faculties, and his wife. So things really moved very fast. We held the first conference. The monograph series had not started by then, so it was published by Cambridge University Press, which was the next best we could do. Then we got Dr. Mack agreed in general what the plans should be, the intention should be, and it was decided to hold not exactly a competition, but to invite five groups of architects to submit designs for the MacDonald Institute according to the specification which we had drawn up. And this was one of the unsuccessful designs. This might be the Quinlan Terry one, I don't quite remember. This was another circular concept which mercifully we were spared. as you see, this is the design which came in after we had a refusal of planning permission. This was a major setback. We received a refusal of planning permission because it was thought that the building, the central building, was too large. But fortunately, the architect, Michael Kane of Casson Conder, was a very ingenious man, and he worked out a way whereby the building, which the temporary building at the west, the west building, could be demolished, and the building you see here, this is the model for it, could be built with a smaller central building, and he worked out how that could be done for the same total sum of money. But there were, of course, a whole series of meetings, and Dr. Mack came over regularly and was enthusiastic about many things, less about one or two, which didn't happen, but in general he was very positive. But very sadly, it was shortly after this project had been agreed in February of 1989 that in February 1990 I should say that he went back to the Isle of Man where he was living and then very sadly died suddenly. So this was a great blow, and there we have the portrait of Dr. MacDonald, which you will see, as you've probably seen before, in the MacDonald Institute, which we had already commissioned and had available. And this is the first edition of the Cambridge Archaeological Journal, which Dr. MacDonald had seen in proof before he went back to the Isle of Man and sadly passed away. And these are the papers, the collected papers, the origins of metrology, which Chris Scar had edited, Dr. MacDonald's papers, and this Dr. MacDonald had been working on, and so was well advanced by the time of his untimely death. So that was a very sad setback, but the plans went ahead, and he had made provision, his bequest had made provision that they should go ahead, and so things did go ahead. And there you see the West Building as it turned out, and here you have the main building, the central building, the courtyard building as it turned out, and there you have the foundation stone which was laid by Dr. MacDonald's widow, Mrs. Winifred MacDonald, in 1992, and so the project went ahead. And so I turn now to the opening of the building, which was in November 1994, and His Royal Highness Prince Charles, who of course was a graduate of the Department of Archaeology, very kindly agreed to open the building. And so here you see two portrait busts from Dr. Mack's collection. He left a great many works of art, a great many important paintings to the Fitzwilliam Museum. And here you see Barry Kemp, who is one of the other people who met Dr. MacDonald in the early years and in whose work Dr. MacDonald took a keen interest, in one of the rooms in the central building. So here you see the Prince of Wales on the left meeting Dr. MacDonald's widow with Malcolm MacDonald, his son, on the right. And there is David Williams, who was then the Vice-Chancellor, making these opening speech just after, in fact, just after Prince Charles had unveiled the memorial stone, the celebratory stone. And so now I take you round some of the laboratories. There you see, as some of you will recognize, Charlie French sharing a joke with the Prince of Wales. There you have Marsha Levine in the archaeozoology laboratory. There you have the Lord Lieutenant and Chris Scar and the Pitt Rivers Professor with the Vice Chancellor. And there is Michael Caine, of Casson Condor, who is the architect of the building, for which we're very grateful, because the building has worked exceedingly well. There is our chairman this evening, who is Dr. MacDonald's representative on the management committee. There is Ruth Daniel, Glyn Daniel's widow, who knew Prince Charles already well. And there's Anne McBurney, Mrs. McBurney, on the right. And there is Mrs. Mellors, now Lady Mellors, on that occasion. Now, I haven't mentioned that it was just a couple of years before the opening, but after the foundation of the Institute, that we had another piece of really good fortune, This was the decision of Mrs. Stella Pitt Rivers, the widow of Captain George Pitt Rivers, and of the Pitt Rivers family, to institute a new chair for archaeology in Cambridge. In discussion, we agreed it would be appropriate that it should be a chair of the of archaeological science. And so there, in this historic slide, we see the first Pitt Rivers professor, Martin Jones. We see Mr. Kellam Digby Jones, who was the representative of Mrs. Pitt Rivers during the discussions. There is Anthony Pitt Rivers, the son of Captain George by a previous wife. And in the background there, you see a bust of George Pitt Rivers himself. So it was a very happy conjuncture that we had a professor of archaeological science together with these new wonderful science laboratories. Well, there you see the statutes. I won't read the statutes or the opening statute for the MacDonald Institute, because you've heard it already. It was what I read you earlier. And that was very satisfactory. That was agreed by Dr. Mack. But I will read you this. A particular focus of the new institute will be the development of the human mind and its expression. Human cognition is one of the key areas of archaeological thinking at the present day, encapsulating a wide range of those activities which give the human species its unique character and separate us most clearly from our near relatives, the non-human primates. Art, symbolism, mensuration, religion, and language. And so that was agreed with Dr. Mack, and that set the direction which we've tried to follow. Well, it's not difficult to list the early priorities. The first was to try and enhance the academic community, and so the coffee room is an essential component of that, and these nice premises where I hope we'll all enjoy a drink before too long. The three initial laboratories, the Cambridge Archaeological Journal I referred to, the Fieldwork and Research Fund. We had fellows, including fellows in cognitive archaeology, the monographs, and then three interests of my own were among the early priorities, the Illicit Antiquities Research Centre, the Archaeogenetics Lab, which was the fourth lab that was set up, and also some study in the prehistory of languages. There we see Katie Boyle and Deborah Parr, who was one of the early secretaries, Mim Bauer and Peter Forster on the top right, you see Neil Brodie and Jenny Doole of the Illicit Antiquities Research Centre, and Liz Farmer, Chris Scar and Dora Kemp, and then Steve Fishpool and Colin Lomas. Colin Lomas has been the financial wizard since the beginning and keeps the accounts in order. So these were the staff at the time I completed my tenure as Disney professor. So now I want to spend just a little time telling you what I think we did in the first decade or so, we shall hear from Graham what has been going on in the very active recent 7 or 8 years, and what plans he has for the Institute for the future. So, first of all, the laboratories, archaeobotany laboratory, and I'm grateful to Martin Jones for supplying these slides, Phytolis, the work of Marco Medella, has been carrying our understanding of plant diet back many, many centuries and millennia. I'm only sort of hitting some highlights. There isn't time to go into details, but I'm just trying to indicate the range of activities, starting with the laboratories. This is further work, ancient DNA work on wheat, and the interest in China and the development of the plant foods of China is continuing, I know, in the laboratory. And here was a rather pleasant enterprise which Delwyn Samuels undertook, recreating Egyptian beer. This was a little creative experimental archaeology based on her research. And the beer was bottled in small quantities and sold out very rapidly. Then the geomorphology laboratory, part of the work, of course, has been many projects, and I'm just hitting on a few to indicate how the MacDonald Institute's good laboratory space has encouraged the scientific work which has gone on, and so the micromorphology at Çatalhöyük has produced a whole series of interesting results. Charlie French, of course, has been active in a whole number of directions, and here is work undertaken at Cranbourne Chase, which indicated how the stability of the environment had been established much earlier in the third millennium BC than had been realized, and this, of course, was partly through pedological study. And then I chose this other piece of work in New Mexico, partly to emphasize how widely the geomorphological work has been practiced, but mainly because I was rather staggered by this section, which I thought was certainly something to write home about. Of course, there's a lot of alluviation as well as erosion in the changing environment in New Mexico, and one very interesting question was the extent to which the indications of burning, the episodes of burning, arose through lightning strikes or perhaps through deliberate human activity to clear the land to allow regeneration of the vegetation. There's been much work, of course, in the archaeozoology laboratory, and here you see Jeff Bailey, who started as its director. It's now Preston Miracle, here are some of the publications that have risen or part of the spin-off. Some of this relates to Marsha Levine's work on the domestication of the horse, which of course is one of the great stories, one of the great controversies in European and indeed Asian archaeology. Now, the Fund for Fieldwork and Research has indeed had some striking early and indeed recent successes. The excavations of the late David Oates and Joan Oates at Tel Brak have been enormously successful. This huge Tel Mound, 30 metres above the plain in Syria, in the early Assyrian period, was an important palace. Here you see the palace and related buildings, the facade of one of these, and an important hoard of bronze artifacts which was found. And I'm trying to stress in this lecture that there really has been an end product to all of these projects, and the end product in many cases has been published by the MacDonald Institute itself, and here are two of the Tel Brak volumes. The same is true of Professor Meller's work at Star Car, and the same is also true of Barry Kemp's work at Tel El Amarna, and here are two views of the palace and then of the reconstructed Aten Temple and of the workman's village. And that is a long-standing excavation, which of course was started much earlier, but taken over by Barry Kemp, and indeed he's continuing it now, although he is retired from his university chair. Prise La Charrière was one of the main projects of Chris Scar, And it's a fascinating site, started around 4000 BC. It's maybe called a megalithic tomb or generally a chamber tomb, but it's a long mound, and the long mound was constructed uniting a passage grave and other structures of a slightly earlier period. And then my own excavations on Keros had already taken place, the first phase, and this is an image of the first phase in 1987, and there is the publication of the 87 excavations and of a more recent conference. I have been excavating in Keros more recently, from 2006 to 2008, but I'm trying not to focus too much on the past decade in this lecture. I'm trying to deal with the past, so I move on to mention Kilise Tepe, Professor Pothgate's excavations, and Anthony Snodgrass's project with John Bintliff, the Boeotia survey project. And then last but certainly not least is Ian Hodder's project at Çatalhöyük, which left the MacDonald Institute when he moved away, but these are publications of the MacDonald Institute in that series. Now coming towards the conclusion, cognitive archaeology has been one of the fields which the MacDonald Institute has deliberately sought to explore. We realise that cognitive archaeology, trying to understand something of the human mind and its development, and of cognitive structures and their development, is a really important field. These fellows, these early fellows, have all, in their way, made significant contributions. So has the work of Dr. Mellers and colleagues. I put on the screen one early conference, Modelling the Early Human Mind, and then a much more recent conference. I hope I'm not stealing any of Professor Barker's thunder by referring to it, because I'm trying to stress that there has been a continuity in the way we've tried to pursue some of the key themes. We already saw this cover of the Ancient Mind, which was the first MacDonald conference, but there have been several others in the field of cognitive archaeology, and they have indeed been published, many of them under the auspices of the MacDonald Institute. These again are recent publications, but I put them on to emphasize that there has been a continuity in direction, I had the opportunity to appoint a Balzan research fellow, Lambros Malafouris, and again this is work in the past decade, this led to two other interesting conferences when neurobiology or neurophysiology was an important theme. So the Illicit Antiquities Research Centre was set up at a time when there was real concern, as indeed there still is, a real concern that antiquities were being looted all over the world, that museums all over the world were buying them, and that the whole system seemed to be largely unregulated. Neil Brody, assisted by Jenny Doole, did a number of things in a very active way. The periodical Culture Without Context was launched became a very influential journal, and we held an important conference on trade in illicit antiquities, and I think it's fair to say that it was partly as a result of these activities that the Dealing in Cultural Objects Offences Act was passed by Parliament and brought into effect in the year 2003. The museums in this country, and this is largely the work of the Museums Association, which commissioned this pamphlet, this small volume, Stealing History, which was also contributed to by Peter Watson, the Museums Association in this country has adopted a very strong policy about acquisitions, following the rule that one doesn't buy any antiquities or acquire any antiquities that have appeared on the market after 1990, the year of the UNESCO Convention, unless one can be sure in a positive sense where they came from. And so I think that did really made an important contribution. The work is still needs to be carried forward. Dr. Pretty made me promise not to mention the Crosby Garrett helmet in my lecture, so I won't say anything more about that, but I will be doing so tomorrow morning in the House of Lords. The archaeogenetics laboratory was something which we were fortunate in being able to set up under the leadership of Peter Fowler, and we also had his co-workers Matthew Hurls and Shuichi Matsumura, and the focus was on mitochondrial DNA and on Y chromosome DNA. I don't have time to say very much about that now, except to say that it was a very lively and remains a very lively field of research. Peter Forster, produced one of the early maps documenting the out of Africa expansion of our species. This, of course, was work by a number of teams and a number of scholars, but he brought it together in a very convenient synthesis, where you see about 80,000 years ago the different mitochondrial DNA haplotypes and haplogroups M and N leaving Africa, and then in later years spreading and having their own descendants spreading across the globe. And this is still one of the best understood phenomena in archaeogenetics. And so we have been active in publications in that direction also. And it was at the Y chromosome consortium meeting in the MacDonald Institute that the nomenclature for the Y chromosome was finally agreed. I myself have an interest in the early prehistory of language. Indeed, I believe that it was through reading of my book, Archaeology and Language, that Dr. MacDonald first thought that he might like to come to Cambridge, which was fortunate. And we've had a number of conferences in the theme of prehistoric languages. Obviously, it's not an easy theme because you don't have a written record of prehistoric languages. But I won't go into the principles which operate. There are very strong principles which do operate, and very strong controversies. And one of the things we did was examine the Nostratic hypothesis. We had the good fortune of having Aharon Dolgopolsky come to explain it to us, and indeed his Nostratic dictionary is published by the MacDonald Institute, although it's not something that you need to refer to every day. Certainly in my case. So we've had a number of controversial and, I think, stimulating conferences, and again, they've been speedily published. Examining the farming language dispersal hypothesis was an important and effective conference, and then subsequently, and much more recently, this again is a publication in Graham Barker's time, but I wanted just to refer to it because it gives an indication of the continuity of interest. And phylogenetic methods, which are methods which have been largely developed in the molecular biological field and related fields in the natural sciences, are being increasingly applied to historical linguistics to very good effect. So the last point I want to make is that I think part of the secret of what I hope can be considered a success and will in the future be considered a success has been the publication program of the MacDonald Institute, in particular the monographs. which Chris Scar set up and which Dora Kemp has energetically produced impeccably from the beginning until the present and through, I hope, into the future. And so here you see the MacDonald Institute monographs, which were published during my own time as director, and there have been a major series following during Graham Barker's time as director. So my penultimate slide is this, which is again a recent publication, although not of the MacDonald Institute, but it relates to a conference which we held here at MacDonald Institute on the archaeology of measurement. And Ian Morley and I have edited this volume. And again, it reflects a continuity, and that's why I've placed it in this photograph on top of Dr. MacDonald's book, The Origins of Metrology, because it's examining the same ideas which he was following in a number of ways, and I think this book in particular would have been of interest to him. So my last slide is indeed our founder, so it gives me very great pleasure to invite Kate Pretty to introduce the second director of the MacDonald Institute for Archaeological Research and the 11th Disney Professor of Archaeology. Thank you.
There are continuities and continuities. Listen to this. Remember what I told you about Colin. Now what I will tell you about Graham, who is, of course, also the Disney Professor, the 11th, and the director of the MacDonald Institute. Guess where he went to college? St. John's. And he did not choose to go to the British School in Athens. He went to the British School in Rome. So there are some differences. But he then went to Sheffield. And so the two of you have been chasing each other for some considerable time. However, I would argue to you that they are two quite different people. Graham Barker, I think, would profess to understand the Mousterian question. And indeed, on Friday night, so well did he understand it that he presented Sir Paul Mellors with a bead-making equipment bought from Jarrell's in Norwich so that he could practice modern human behaviour. Graham, I don't know what you're liking, the cold climates, because instead, unlike Colin, you're choosing to work in much warmer climes, and particularly in the tropics. One of the things I'd like to just comment on is the importance both of Chris Scar and of James Barrett to the two directors. It is no mean feat to manage an institute which is 20 years old. I have never seen the impassioned plea that I saw through Teard's emails from geology, which is, who's left the rocks under the pigeonholes? Because somehow in the MacDonald, the rocks get managed. But of course, we don't know much about the deposition in the basements yet. 20 years is a long time to have been hosting archaeologists, and these things develop over time. One of the things that is, I suppose, a hallmark of the MacDonald Institute is that it is for all archaeologists in the University of Cambridge and indeed many beyond. And we have the pleasure on the management committee of working with people in faculties and departments which are not part of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences. And indeed, of course, work closely with colleagues in biological anthropology and in social anthropology. And this is one of the things which we had perhaps not foreseen when we first understood how the Institute might work, but is now an important part of our work going forward. One of the things that is important about that is that it brings many different collaborations to work in the MacDonald. The seminar room is never empty. The basements are always full. And indeed, one of the hallmarks of the present and the future going on is the sheer volume of people who are now working there. But I would make one comment to you which would have pleased Dr. Mack. He always meant that we should use the endowment and the building to make money. The archaeology, broadly conceived across this particular school, is the largest single earner of research income in the whole of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences. And that is something that we owe partly to the base of having this particular institute to work with. Because Graham, I don't know what, how you're going to follow Colin in that act, and because he has, of course, simply allowed you to differentiate yourself, we are no longer at St. John's. We are no longer, well, you both are, of course, still as fellows. We are no longer at Sheffield. You're here as the new Disney professor. You're here as the second director of the Institute. We look forward to hearing your vision for how you're going to build on the foundations so ably set by Colin Renfrew. This is Professor Graham Barker.
Dora, come and rescue me. I should say,
I should say, before I say anything else, actually, that as always, Dora has saved me.
It's okay. <You're safe. laughs>
No, we're not fully up, actually. Where's the thing? I haven't used a Mac. Where's the... Come back.
I need to get to the next slide. That's
really?
What's showing on the screen.
Yeah,
that's
no, what... Oh, I see.
That's fine.
Good. Colin has sketched out the beginnings of the Institute and its remarkable achievements under his leadership. It was a quite impossible act to follow when I took over the directorship as his successor in October 2004. But I can certainly say that over the ensuing years, supported by the wise counsel and energies of the deputy directors Chris Scar and now James Barrett, it's been a unique privilege and pleasure to serve as the Institute's second director. A month after I arrived, we celebrated a very pleasurable birthday with the first of many heart-stopping chocolate cakes from Fitzbillies, the 10th anniversary of the opening of the Institute's courtyard building. In the annual report for that year, I wrote that, seeing the breadth and vitality of the staff and postgraduate research community gathered to enjoy the birthday cake, the notices in the background of a host of forthcoming lectures, workshops, seminars and conferences, and all the MacDonald publications for sale in the foyer, I was forcefully reminded of the remarkable impact the MacDonald Institute has had since its inception on archaeology at Cambridge, and on the archaeological community at large. And this afternoon, I just really want to celebrate that continuing impact. I should begin by commenting briefly on the somewhat mysterious relationship to those inside and outside the Institute in equal measure between the Institute, the Department of Archaeology, and the wider university. The Institute is the research arm of the Department of Archaeology. It's the base for our postdoctoral research fellows. And it supports research of the wider community of Cambridge archaeologists through grants towards their fieldwork, conference organisation and publication. This wider community of archaeologists is working variously in the Cambridge Archaeological Unit, the Leverhulme Centre for Human Evolutionary Studies, or ELCHES, the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, the Faculty of Classics, the Fitzwilliam Museum, the Institute of Continuing Education, and various colleges. And there are people with archaeology-related research interests in several other departments too. Everybody knows what archaeologists do, in the sense that there is something called archaeology on TV virtually every evening, with Time Team the leader of the pack. Its phenomenal success has been both a blessing and a curse for the discipline. A blessing in that it makes the public aware of the fun and human interest of the subject, human interest in terms of both the excitement of digging up history and of the people doing the digging, wild-haired eccentrics apparently all. But Time Team is also a curse, because nobody on the programme looks like having a proper job. It shows that the subject can be enormous fun, which it is, and it's a team activity par excellence. It shows that after the fun and games in the trenches, people in white coats do clever things in the lab, which indeed they do. But it rarely shows that archaeologists, like historians, have important things to say about the past.
things which may also have considerable relevance for our present and future lives. In one of his more asinine newspaper columns, Jeremy Clarkson once commented that the only purpose of archaeology is so that stupid people can go to university. So who has the MacDonald Institute been supporting these past few years, and what have they been getting up to? I must apologise in advance to colleagues and to their many collaborators, because most of us are working with lots of collaborators, and to past and present research fellows whose work I haven't been able to do justice to in this brief talk or even mention. But I hope to convey something of the importance of the themes and questions that Cambridge archaeologists are tackling, that we've been supporting. We research the entirety of the human career from the beginnings of our history to the archaeology of the 20th century, and hence the title of the lecture. We work in most regions of the world. We work with methods drawn from the entire spectrum of the discipline, from archaeological sciences to humanities approaches, including the study of texts. And one of the most important strengths of what we do is that the science and humanities approaches are frequently used in tandem to investigate a problem without privileging either. To exemplify this variety and richness, I want to comment briefly on six major themes: environment, resources, landscape, power, imagination and identity, or cognition and identity, and the politics of the past. Some of the most important developments in human prehistory and history took place at times of highly unstable climates. One of the major findings in Pleistocene or Ice Age studies in recent years has been the demonstration of the extreme rapidity with which climates could shift, if not in one person's memory, then certainly within a scale that people would have been aware of from the stories that their parents and grandparents told. To advance debates about whether or not climate was a major driver of human behavioural change in these deep periods of early prehistory, we have to be able to drill down to understand how changes in climate and weather were actually experienced by these people at this place at this time. One important area of Cambridge research, led by Tamsin O'Connell and Rhiannon Stevens in the New Isotope Lab, has been to develop methods for reconstructing environment and thus climate in deep prehistory at this local or human scale, by extracting isotopic indicators of climate from the bones and teeth of the animals that the people were actually hunting. Archaeology can also contribute importantly to our understanding of how particular societies in the past perceived changes to climate and environment, and why they responded to them in the ways that they did. We can do this over really long timescales compared with historical sources. In my own current project in Libya, for example, reinvestigating the famous Howrah Fetir cave excavated by Cambridge's Charles McBurney, Paul's predecessor, in the 1950s, its deep sequence means that we can study how climate and people interacted over probably the last 200,000 years, the antiquity of our species in Africa. In Ethiopia, it used to be thought that the Aksumite state of the first millennium AD collapsed because of land degradation caused by massive land clearance. But Charlie French has found evidence around Aksum for considerable landscape stability and resilience, but other examples elsewhere of poor systems of land use. In southern Peru, he and David Beresford-Jones are studying cycles of cultural fluorescence and collapse over the past 3,000 years along the Ica Valley, an area now depopulated and empty of cultivation, but which intermittently sustained a dense population of irrigation farmers between about 750 BC and the end of the Inca Empire. In India, Cameron Petrie and his collaborator Ravinder Singh are coordinating an investigation of long-term relationships between climate, irrigation systems and state maintenance in the Indus Valley, the focus being the rise and fall of the Harappan civilization of the second millennium BC. Two studies that I've been involved with, largely before I came here, using a similar combination of archaeological and geographical techniques, studied land use history in parts of Libya and Jordan that are now arid desert, but which have impressive remains of ancient farms and other monuments of the Roman period. The Libyan farmers attempted to manage and control erosion, whereas the Jordanian farmers stripped the landscape bare of timber and it's never recovered. What these archaeological projects are showing is that there were no simple pathways to success or failure in human-environmental interactions. People variously took wise or foolish decisions in the face of landscape change, whether climatically or humanly induced, related especially to the social context and political structures in which they lived. Another major focus of research is the domestication and ensuing management of plants and animals. The development of farming is commonly regarded as one of the great milestone developments in human history, fueling the growth of dense sedentary populations that provided the critical context for the growth of social inequality. Archaeological scientists at Cambridge have been making major contributions to our understanding of the process. Martin Jones's group has led the way here, illuminating the pathways by which wheat and barley were first domesticated in the Near East and then spread across Europe. More recently, his group has focused on the domestication of millet in China. The next phase of this work is to bring these two stories together, tracing the timing and routes by which the European crops spread to China and the millets to Europe in around the 3rd millennium BC. Mimbauer has found a similarly complex history of relationships between people and horses across the steppes of the ex-USSR and China. Their genetics imply multiple domestication, or rather semi-domestication, events across the steppes, and the widespread mixing of far-flung horse populations already by the 3rd millennium BC. This study has been further illuminated by Marsha Levine's studies of the pathologies or bone deformations caused to horses by riding, and Krish Sitar's studies of the population histories using computer modelling of changes in tooth shape. James Barrett has been using isotope studies of cod bones from archaeological sites to track the intensification of deep sea fishing in the North Sea in response to growing urban populations in the medieval period. And one of the interesting byproducts of this work has been the interest of modern fisheries in the range and diversity of medieval fish stocks in the North Sea as a measure of its former biodiversity. Using the techniques of archaeological science to document changes in animals and plants is only part of the approach, however, because at the heart of archaeology as a historical discipline is the core project of trying to understand why people took the actions that they did. In the rainforest of Borneo, for example, I've been working with a team of anthropologists and geographers to try to understand how the forest is used today by Penan foragers, hunter-gatherers, and Kelabit rice farmers, and how it was used in the past. We found that rice was used intermittently for thousands of years, from about 6,000, 7,000 years ago, but it only became a food staple a few hundred years ago with European colonisation. Today, the Penan pride themselves on how they only leave footprints in the forest, whereas the Kelabit see themselves as setting themselves apart from the forest with their cemeteries, ceremonial monuments, and especially their rice fields. The diet of the two communities is in fact very similar in that both depend heavily on the wild plants and animals of the forest, but both recognise that growing rice is the great divide. All other plants, which we would class as variously wild or domestic, are put into one category and rice into another as the plant that needs people to grow it. For these communities, as for many others in Southeast Asia, rice has sacred or quasi-sacred status. Its growing is highly ritualised, and growing it and eating it are associated with status and prestige. We can't bolt the present simplistically onto the past, but it does seem very likely that for thousands of years, growing rice was as much about cultivating social relationships as feeding people, or it was more about cultivating social relationships. As archaeologists, we have to try to grapple as much with the social context in which resources were variously acquired or resisted by past societies as with the science. Neither approach has all the answers, and the MacDonald Institute has been promoting both. Places inhabited by humans are as much cultural as natural landscapes. Indeed, many past societies probably wouldn't have understood the distinction. For me, working with the Kelabit and Penan has been an eye-opener as to how, for them, the entire forest is imbued with memories and myths of special places and things linked to spirits, to real or mythical ancestors. For earlier prehistory, some of our best insights about how people used and created the landscapes they inhabited have come from cave excavations, caves being useful sumps of cultural and environmental information. Here are four such projects. We've got Brian Stewart in Lesotho, Professor Miracle in Bosnia, myself at Near Cave in Borneo, and Ryan Rabet, who's also actually the person digging a Near Cave there, working his site in Vietnam. Another key focus has been the highly ritualised landscapes of many prehistoric societies in Britain, such as the Cambridgeshire Fens, where the survival of waterlogged wood and other organic remains gives us unique insights into prehistoric life. I think we should celebrate the achievements of the Cambridge Archaeology Unit, especially here. Or the chalk lands of southern England, for example, on Cranbourne Chase that we've heard about, and around Stonehenge, where Charlie French is leading the Cambridge contribution to a hugely successful multi-university study coordinated by Mike Parker Pearson of Sheffield. Equally informative have been survey projects taking the long view, the long durée, to use the French historian Braudel's famous phrase, of how successive societies alter their landscapes or preserve past structures and memories. Examples include John Robb's work with classical archaeology colleagues at Bova Marina in southern Italy, Simon Stoddart's study of the landscape history of the island of Lismore in Scotland, or his new project looking at changing political boundaries of Etruscan, Roman and medieval communities in central Italy, or Sue Westhaynes' analysis of the arable and pastoral landscapes of the Anglo-Saxon period in East Anglia and the extent to which they represent continuities or breaks with the prehistoric and Roman past. The development of social inequality and the formation and nature of states and empires are a subject of study for an unusually strong group of Cambridge scholars working variously with the ancient Old World states of Mesopotamia, Egypt and India, the complex Bronze Age and Iron Age societies of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Greco-Roman world, medieval Europe, and the indigenous states of the Americas and of Africa prior to European colonisation. Most are working in situations where the archaeological evidence and documentary sources need to be used in tandem. At Pre-Inca Bulgata in northwest Argentina, Elizabeth de Mary's excavations revealed a society best described as heterarchical, in which power was decentralised, flexible, ambiguous and shared, rather than organised in the hierarchical structures that are frequently assumed to be some kind of automatic stage before state formation. Her findings challenge the orthodox view that top-down political leadership and hierarchy necessarily developed as communities grew in size and complexity. Augusta McMahon's work at BRAC, that we've already heard about from Joan Oates' work there, is telling us a great deal about the character of the earliest urbanism in the world. Clay ceilings, the stamps made by seals on baskets and jars, testify to the network of economic exchanges and the accounting systems that recorded them, evidence of the complex economic structures necessary to sustain a city. One of the more grisly discoveries, though, has been of mass graves containing several hundred young adults who died in conflict. The bodies appear to have been exposed for several weeks before being thrown into pits naked, without grave goods, and mixed in with the household rubbish, much as if they were animal carcasses. There's evidence of violence in many pre-state communities, societies, but it tends to look highly structured, almost ceremonial, with fatal casualties the exception rather than the norm. Here is something very different. It's notable that the cemeteries are contemporary with ceilings showing kings in conflict with lions, a common iconography emphasising the links between these early leaders and their capacity for violence. The dead probably relate to warfare between the inhabitants of Brac and its dependent hinterland in the context of the city's growing wealth and power. Interestingly, there are many indicators of malnutrition and stress in the dead. Life for many people in these early states was clearly nasty, brutish and short. And it didn't get better. The excavations in Turkey by Nicholas Postgate at Kilisi Tepe and John McGuinness at Ziyaret Tepe are telling us an enormous amount about the character of urban life in the later Near Eastern empires, respectively the Hittites of the late 2nd and the Assyrians of the mid-1st millennia BC. An unexpected but important discovery at Ziyaret Tepe was an archive of cuneiform tablets dated to a couple of years before the final collapse of the Assyrian Empire. The textual studies by Nicholas and John of this kind of material reveal the complex and often cruel apparatus of state administration that was developed by these early empires to control their subject peoples and extract resources from the conquered lands. Life wasn't much better for most people at the heart of empire either. For example, Barry Kemp's long-running study of Amarna in Egypt, the short-lived capital built by the pharaoh Akhenaten, and abandoned shortly after his death in 1332 BC, has found that the people who built and maintained this desert city bear all the signs of harsh living conditions, indifferent health, and foreshortened lives. Akhenaten also established the colonial output of Sesebi in modern northern Sudan to defend the southern border of his state, and Kate Spence and Pam Rose have started working here to clarify the identity of the inhabitants and their lifestyles and their relations to the surrounding population. In the case of the Roman Empire too, the Institute has supported work by Martin Millis and colleagues, for example, both at the heart of empire, in the case of Martin, at Portus, the principal port of Imperial Rome, and in a typical small rural settlement in a frontier region at Thwing in Yorkshire. Both projects have used a range of archaeological science to reveal details of the lifeways of the inhabitants from organic remains that couldn't be gleaned from either the documentary record or material culture. A similar approach characterises James Barrett's work on the Viking diaspora. His excavations at Coigru and the Brough of Dearness in the Orkneys are revealing heterarchical power structures sustained by fishing, trading and piracy. And with funding from the Mellon Foundation, James also organised a major series of seminars addressing the nature and reasons for the systematic collapse that frequently characterises states. Scholars brought to bear the perspectives of archaeology, history, geography, linguistics, numismatics, genetics and other disciplines to debate the nature of and potential reasons for major episodes of economic crisis and cultural collapse in Europe in the 4th, 19th and 14th centuries. And there was a final conference that took a comparative perspective to contextualise the European case studies with examples of crises and collapses in different historical contexts, from the Mesopotamian empires to New Zealand Maori societies before European colonisation. It was a kind of event that showed the McDonald at its best for promoting interdisciplinarity. An abiding interest of the Institute has always been in the development of the human mind. Can archaeologists investigate the complexities of how past societies thought about themselves and the worlds they inhabited, as Colin described? One important focus has been the cognitive changes associated with the emergence and spread of our species, Homo sapiens, a process memorably described by Paul Mellers as the human revolution. When, how and why did modern ways of thinking develop, in the sense of using complex spoken language, employing abstract reasoning and so on? It's the area of study that links us most closely with the research agenda of ELCHES, the centre established a few years ago by Rob Foley and Marta Lahr, both of whom have made seminal contributions to this research agenda. Our basic anatomy is present in Africa by at least 200,000 years ago, and the critical mutation of the gene that encodes the capacity for complex language is likely to be of the same antiquity. Archaeologists have tackled the challenging task of trying to recognise the development of cognitive complexity in Stone Age material culture by defining a set of proxy indicators like complex multi-stage technologies, economic specialisation, the deliberate disposal of the dead, the use of symbolism, for example, in what we can refer to as art. All of these things appear to have characterised modern humans when they arrived in Europe 40,000 years ago, where they eventually outcompeted Neanderthals. Much of the debate has been about whether cognitive complexity developed in fits and starts over a very long period of time, and if so, how and why, or as a sudden step change in response to some kind of major pressure, such as a major environmental pressure or demographic one. These debates were the focus of a major conference on rethinking the human revolution, organised by Paul Mellers, published by the Institute, as we saw, in 2007. And they're further explored in a festschrift of essays presented to, now Sir Paul, to our delight, by his friends and colleagues last Friday. Some of the imaginative ways in which staff and postdoctoral research fellows have been tackling the human revolution problem have included through hunting practices, Preston Miracle and Ryan Rabet, food preparation and sharing, Martin Jones, lithic technologies, Adam Brum, the origins of music, Ian Morley, the development of figurative art and belief systems, Colin Renfrew. And I've got, say, involved in these things too, for example, in the Nia Cave in Borneo, where we worked. Modern humans 50,000 years ago were using traps and snares to hunt pigs and projectiles to kill animals like orangutan high in the tree canopy. They collected a wide range of roots, tubers, fruits and nuts, removing the toxins that were in many of them by burying them in ash-filled pits. They burnt clearing edges in the forest to enhance their productivity. There are no burials, no art, and virtually no evidence for symbolic behaviour. But the hunting technologies, the pits, the forest burning and so on, all imply sophisticated forward planning. In Australia, the first modern humans arriving around the same time didn't arrive with a package of modern behaviours defined for Homo sapiens in Africa and Europe. It developed piecemeal over the next 30,000 years, in a complex process of acquisition, experimentation, abandonment, accidental loss, and so on. It looks increasingly likely that there was no single pathway to the development of the modern mind, nor, as Clive Gamble comments in Paul's Feshrit, should Paleolithic archaeologists have only one view of how that mind works. As in the British Museum, as the British Museum's 100 objects series has shown so brilliantly, objects are, and have always been, central to human existence. Humans shape and are in turn shaped by the material world. Objects create the context of our social relations, are deployed to produce social effects, and give form to social relations. They help constitute rather than just reflect our social realities. Work on the complicated but eloquent relationship between people and things is at the heart of a great deal of Cambridge archaeological research that we've supported. Whether people are working with small-scale prehistoric societies, the ancient civilizations, the medieval world, or the archaeology of recent centuries. The Institute has just established a new laboratory of material culture studies to be headed by Elizabeth DeMarais and John Robb to provide a base for the many graduate students working in this field of study. One major theme has been, as in Colin Renfrew's Roots of Spirituality project, has been what objects can tell us about the different ways in which past societies have created ideologies, religious practices, and belief systems. With Ian Morley and Lambros Malathouris, as we heard, he's organised three major conferences on art, cognition, and metrication. And then in his excavations on the Greek island of Keros, he's discovered an extraordinary ritual deposit dating to the Bronze Age, to which thousands of small statuettes were brought and deliberately broken before being buried. Lila Janek has shown how rock art, incised drawings on glacial boulders made by prehistoric hunter-fisher gatherers in Russian Karelia, hint at shamanistic belief systems of a form not so different from those recorded ethnographically amongst the peoples of the far north. Chris Chippendale has applied the same approaches to prehistoric rock art in the Alpine region and to the rock art in northern Australia made by the ancestors of present-day Aboriginal populations. And for early farming societies too, we've learned a huge amount about how complex belief systems structured their lives and imbued their landscapes, from the work that we've heard about of Chris Scar at his Neolithic megalithic site in northwest France, the Cambridge contributions to Ian Hodder's wonderful excavations at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, and the excavations by Caroline Malone and Simon Stoddart of the Neolithic Brockdorf Circle on the island of Gozo, one of the many extraordinary Neolithic temples made by the prehistoric inhabitants of Malta and Gozo between about 3,500 and 2,500 BC. The structuring roles of the organised religious systems of later literate societies have also been explored, for example, by Barry Kemp and Kate Spence in the case of the ancient Egyptians, David Phillipson, the previous director of the Museum of Akhenaten, on the medieval rock-cut churches of Lalibela in Ethiopia, and until religious extremism made fieldwork impossible by one of our former postdocs, Alison Gascoigne, on the archaeology of early Islam in Afghanistan. And a related area of study for us has been the human body, because how we see, how we use our bodies, decorate them, imagine them in art, treat them in death, and so on, is one of the few topics for which a cross-cultural comparative study of changing beliefs is possible. The highlight of this work has been the Leverhulme research programme, Changing Beliefs of the Human Body, a major interdisciplinary project coordinated by John Robb. This brought together Cambridge archaeologists, anthropologists and historians to consider why and how humans have changed what they believe about the human body from deep prehistory to our own world of tattoos, cosmetic surgery and transplants. Supported by a team of postdoctoral researchers including Dusan Boric, Catherine Rebe and Oliver Harris, the project involved a series of workshops and conferences now published or being prepared for publication and culminated in a wonderful exhibition in the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology called Crossing Bodies that attracted some 100,000 visitors, which closed last week. The third major area of materiality studies concerns identity, how we see ourselves, present ourselves and imagine ourselves akin to or different from other people. Despite what politicians might like to tell us about Englishness, Britishness, Europeanness, big societies or whatever, we all have multiple identities in terms of gender, age group, language, social groupings, belief systems and ethnicities. The body, of course, is the medium for experiencing and expressing multiple and hybrid identities. Some of the most interesting work on this has been by Dusan Boric,
studying the settlement and cemeteries of the prehistoric communities who lived by the Danube at a critical period of transition from foraging to farming around 7,000 years ago. Marie-Louise Sorensen has used dress and changing burial patterns in Bronze Age Europe to show how ethnicities and beliefs shifted in multifaceted ways in a process of experimentation that combined familiar and unfamiliar ways of doing things. In Britain, the debate about the origins of the English has been characterised by polarised theories of wholesale population replacement at the end of the Roman period, or some kind of apartheid between locals and invaders. And a detailed study by Catherine Hills and Tamsin O'Connell of two Anglo-Saxon cemeteries in the Thames Valley, combining material culture studies, skeletal studies, isotope analysis and radiocarbon dating, shows complicated shifts in identities in the 5th and 6th centuries AD, with no evidence for clearly separated native and incomer populations. As Catherine comments, the official identity of England and its rulers may have changed, but the majority of people in this new country were descended from those who lived in the old. Such questions about Englishness bring me to my final theme, the importance of the past for the present. I've already described how there's increasing scientific interest in what archaeology can tell us about climate change and human responses to it, about the sustainability or otherwise of past land use systems, about the nature of terrestrial and marine biodiversity before industrialisation, and so on. The important role of the Elista Antiquities Centre in arguing for better ethical standards in the antiquities market is also obvious. But the past also matters enormously for how present-day societies see themselves. The last century and the first decade of the present century have been notable for conflicts driven by questions of identity, of perceived ethnic or religious differences. Marie-Louise Sorensen is coordinating the work of a large European team looking at how cultural heritage has been used or is being used to reconstruct notions of identity amongst European societies affected by conflict in the last century, such as Bosnia, Cyprus, Northern Ireland and Spain. Alongside academic papers and books, one important outcome of the project, the CRIC project it's called, for the EU, will be a set of policy recommendations regarding cultural reconstructions after conflict. In the Channel Islands, Gilly Carr is using the material culture of the Second World War, the objects made by slave workers, by local people, by occupying German troops, the monuments built in the post-war period to commemorate the occupation, along with documents and oral testimonies, to show how the past today is memorialized differently and somewhat uncomfortably by the different island communities. The days are long gone when archaeologists could ignore local communities and be the sole arbiter of wisdom. The Penan and Kelabit have an extremely active interest in the histories that we archaeologists are reconstructing, because demonstrating long-standing links to places in the forest, customary native rights and government speak there, is the principal way that they can try to protect their land from logging. Robin Boast is working with Zuni communities in New Mexico to add their indigenous voices to our understanding of Zuni material in Western ethnographic collections. Working with the Tamu Mai in central Nepal was just as critical for Chris Evans in his study of the archaeology of their homeland as it was for his anthropology collaborator Alan McFarlane working on their ethnography. And working with communities on their past is at the heart of Corenza Lewis's higher education field academies in the East Anglia, as we see here with the Kibworthians of Kibworth, whereby local children dig small test pits in their villages and then study the finds, a project that on the one hand is giving us completely new insights into the history of presently occupied hamlets and villages over the past 1,500 years, and on the other proving hugely successful at raising the aspirations of disadvantaged children to aspire to go to university, not just to study archaeology, but to study any subject. Having concentrated on the achievements of the field and laboratory studies that we've supported, I want to end with three brief observations and an announcement. First, the main achievement of any academic enterprise that one can point to afterwards is what's on the shelf in the public domain. Here we should celebrate the continued expansion of the Cambridge Archaeological Journal under its current editor, John Robb, under the monograph series under James Barrett. I know both of them would want to acknowledge here the enormous commitment of Liz Farmer and Dora Kemp to keeping the show on the road amidst impossible deadlines. This is also a good moment to acknowledge the skill and enthusiasm of the rest of the McDonald's staff, as Colin did, above all Sarah Harrop and Katie Boyle, who support staff in applying for research grants, and Colin Lomas, who chases them for their accounts when they get them. Second, I need to emphasise the transformative and enriching roles that the Institute as a physical entity plays in the everyday lives of the Cambridge archaeological community. It's the focus for a stream of conferences, workshops, seminar groups and lab meetings, which, despite the photographic record, are not simply an excuse for eating and drinking. Nurturing that vitality of intellectual life, of occasions that bring us out of our various comfort zones and invite us into unfamiliar terrain in the intellectual landscape, is something actually which Elchez is also doing brilliantly in its human evolutionary studies, is what underpins Cambridge as a world centre for archaeological research. Most of all, though, the Institute is about people, and especially about early career researchers. Funding for graduate study is increasingly hard to come by, but the opportunities for postdoctoral study, the key transitional stage before a permanent post in any academic discipline, are the most limited of all. The Institute's changing community of 25 to 30 postdoctoral research fellows is certainly one of the largest in archaeology in the world, and it may indeed be the largest. They are the people who've always made and continue to make the Institute what it is. They most represent the subject's future health. And so for this reason, in closing, to celebrate the Institute's 20th anniversary at a time when the career prospects in UK universities look increasingly bleak, the managing committee has decided to commit resources to 5 3-year McDonald anniversary fellowships, appointed in succession over the next 5 years, working within 5 major areas of research of current interest to us: human-environment interaction, social change, symbols, material culture, and heritage. Within these deliberately broad headings, we want each fellow to propose a specific piece of research on which they'll work, but also to place it within a much larger research theme where scholars from different disciplines need to be brought together in the McDonald to clarify and advance the research agenda. An example might be a specific project on paleoclimate that contributes to a wider theme about resilience versus efficiency in human-environment interactions, or a project on figurines that contributes to the wider theoretical question of whether one can ever divide the body from material culture. In addition to the fellow's stipend and funds towards their specific project, we'll provide support to enable the fellow to organise a flagship McDonald conference on their wider theme, to bring together exciting researchers from different disciplines within and outside Cambridge to scope the landscape of the theme and explore potential pathways across it. We want them, the people, and the conference themes to be adventurous rather than risk-averse, and challenging rather than comfortable. But also, as in the work that I've described this afternoon, to continue to affirm why archaeology has important things to say about the human past, and why understanding that past is important for the present and future health of our species. And we're going to be advertising the first of these fellowships very shortly. So, Dr. McDonald, wherever you may be, the Institute and wider Cambridge thanks you for what you've given these past 20 years. I think if he could see that, I think it is a very, very remarkable contribution that he made. For all the slings and arrows of comprehensive spending reviews, Brown reports, and all the rest, and I pass over the internal ramifications of what's going on in the world and within Cambridge for the particular archaeological community, the Institute can surely look forward with every confidence to its future. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, there's an important moral lesson attached to this vote of thanks, which is: last thing before going to any academic event in Cambridge, reopen your email, because there may be a message there saying, will you give a vote of thanks? And it is my failure to do that that accounts for my lack of a gown, and any lack of fluency in this vote of thanks. I can't ask you to join me on the whole of the incredible nostalgia trip that I've just been through, which in fact covers even longer period than the lifetime of the MacDonald Institute. It is more like 50 than 40 years since James Wright, for example, the former Secretary General, was my colleague in the same department in Edinburgh. It is 40 years since Colin Renfrew and I both took part in the same conference on Bronze Age migrations in the Aegean at Sheffield. And it's even 30 years or more since I collaborated with Michael Caine of Casenconda, the architect of the MacDonald building, in a different project on the Sidgwick site. The unique thing about the MacDonald is the way that it brings together everything, almost everything, that could lay claim to the title of archaeology, whether it's things normally treated as separate, hermetically sealed specializations, or whether they have archaeology in their title, like, for example, classical archaeology, but also Chinese archaeology, also Egyptology, also everything that can contribute and can help, as well as be helped by the central themes of world prehistory. The two directors that the Institute has so far had exemplify so well this diversity that they could almost be called personifications of the MacDonald ethos, and I think they have displayed this admirably this evening in a short compass of time. But let me simply echo Kate Pretty's invitation that you should all join us at the Institute for a drink. Thank you very much.